Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to Drinking the Kool-Aid.
Welcome.
I'm Megan.
I'm Hannah.
And we've got a really crazy one today.
Well, you really left me hanging there for a minute.
Yeah. And I think that you might hear some synchronicities with past stories.
Okay.
So we'll see if you pick up on it.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, I will do my best.
You'll pick up on it. I promise.
I will?
Yes, I promise. I promise. I promise.
Okay, cool. Because I was literally just listening to Morbid today, and they were like, oh, we've already covered this story, but we're redoing it. And I was like, well, I've listened to all the episodes until this point, but I do not remember the story at all. So it was new to me again.
No. There's things that you might initially pick up on, and even if you don't, I will lead you there. You'll be fine.
Okay, perfect. Cool.
It's not a test.
Awesome.
So for this one, I watched Captive Audience, A Real American Horror Story, Episode 3, and FBI Criminal Pursuit, Season 1, Episode 9, Trail of Terror. And then I read the book called In the Name of the Children by Jeffrey L. Reinick and Marilee Strong. This is the case of the Yosemite Killer. You're already making a face.
It's all good. I was just trying to, like, see if I could dig into my, like, brain arsenal and remember that, but I don't.
Okay. That's all right. Carol Sund grew up in a family that made millions. She married her high school sweetheart, Jens Sund, and after that, they had their daughter, Juliana, and the couple opened their home to kids in need of a family.
Oh, that's cool.
It's amazing. So they were doing incredible work. They took in foster kids and ended up adopting three children of mixed African-American heritage.
Love it.
Carol spent thousands of hours volunteering with groups that assist foster kids and abused and neglected children. Those most vulnerable to victimization and least able to protect themselves. She joined the NAACP. Is it that or is it NAACP? I don't know.
How the fuck would I know?
Okay.
I was like, wait a second, are you telling the story and you're asking me?
I don't know. I've never heard of it.
What is it?
NAACP. That's probably what it is.
I don't even know what that is.
Okay, I'll tell you.
Okay. What the hell just happened? Wow.
She joined the NAACP to better understand racial issues and to keep her children in touch with their culture. She advocated for abused kids in the legal system, taught parenting classes, and also worked with developmentally disabled adults living in group homes who were trying to establish a measure of independence.
Oh my gosh, so she like really threw herself into this.
Absolutely. She was doing great work. When Carol spent a semester abroad during her senior year in high school, she lived as an exchange student with Raquel Peloso and stayed with her family on their cattle ranch. Carol stayed there for 6 months, and the two of them became best friends, and they exchanged friendship rings. They remained in touch for the next 26 years, and they each got married and had children. Carol traveled to Argentina at one point because she did consider adopting there. Carol's daughter, Julie, and Raquel's second child, Silvina, were toddlers when they first met, but the girls were fast friends, just like their mothers had been. In 1999, Silvina was 16. And Julie was 15. Silvina was invited to stay at the son's home in the Northern California town of Eureka. Two of Julie's friends were sexually assaulted, so she actually started an anti-rape campaign at her school. She had a passion for fighting against victimization, just like her mother, and she also had her adventurous spirit as she planned to visit Silvina in Argentina that summer.
I love that she follows in her mom's footsteps.
Yeah, and seriously, like, what kid puts together an anti-rape campaign at school? That's so amazing. Yeah,
like, beyond amazing, actually.
I was blown away by that. The sons wanted to show Silvina as much as they could while she was here. They went to, like, the popular tourist attractions like Disneyland and San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf. They also wanted to make sure that she got to see some of America's true treasures. So Carol and Julie brought Silvina to Yosemite National Park over President's Day weekend in February of 1999. This was a very special place to Carol because she had honeymooned there with her husband, Jens. At the end of the long weekend, Carol would bring Julie back home and Silvina would fly to Arizona with her, Jens, and the younger son children to visit the Grand Canyon. Carol had the whole thing planned out. She and the girls would fly from Eureka to San Francisco on Friday, February 12th. Then she would rent a car and drive to Stockton. Julie was on the cheer squad at her high school, and she had a competition the following day at the University of the Pacific. On Sunday, they would drive to Yosemite to spend the day touring the park, then drive back to the San Francisco airport on Tuesday, where they would meet up with Jens for the flight to Arizona. So they have a lot packed in here, okay?
I mean, she did a real good job at planning it, though.
Absolutely.
I mean, she had it down.
Yeah. I mean, this is a real tight itinerary here. Carol and Julie were very impressed with the University of the Pacific, and Julie thought that she might want to go to college there. They made plans with another mother who had attended the cheerleading competition, and they were going to meet back there on Tuesday to tour the campus. Carol was confident that they would have time to stop there on the way back from Yosemite, and they could still get to San Francisco to catch their flights. They headed out Sunday morning on Highway 140 for Yosemite, and the route follows along the Merced River. The three of them checked into the Cedar Lodge, just outside the western entrance to the park in the town of El Portal. The lodge had more than 200 rooms in half a dozen separate buildings that were spread out over 27 acres.
Okay, that's actually kind of cool.
It could be. But the way that they had it is not as amazing because the problem is where the building is for like the staff, the managers and such,
okay,
is very far from the rooms and everything's so spread out. Ew. That you're kind of by yourself. So, I mean, okay, it could be really nice in certain aspects, but also not as safe.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was thinking to like that town we have visited before that is really, really far away.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Hold on.
Did we go see a show there?
We did.
Okay, then yes.
Yeah, okay. So, like, they're set up like that.
Yeah.
They have a lot of cabins that are like that. And I actually think that's, like, really cool. I loved it. But now that, like, you've pointed that out. Now the next time, like, if I end up there again, I'm going to be like, son of a bitch.
Yeah. Sorry about that. They were assigned to room 509, and Carol and the girls were the only guests in their entire building. They were extremely far away from the office, and they actually had to drive to get to their room from the office because it was such a long distance. The hotel didn't provide daily maid service, so they would keep renting fresh rooms that were further and further away from the main office until the crew came in to clean them.
Did you say you had to drive to get to the office?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, it is nothing like that.
Right, right, yeah.
No, I mean, it's a little where bit of a walk,
go,
but
yeah, nothing like that. After spending the whole day in the park on Monday, Carol called her husband that afternoon from their hotel room. She told him that the girls had a great time exploring the park, hiking, and ice skating. They were hoping to get a few extra hours in on Tuesday morning before heading to the school tour and the airport. They rented some movies to watch in their room that night, and they were last seen around 7:30 p.m. eating in the diner that was attached to Cedar Lodge. Eyewitnesses at the diner recalled a couple of high school-aged ladies and an adult female stopping by for food. The waitress said that the adult paid for the group's food and they left in a hurry. Carol and the girls did not show up for the campus tour on Tuesday, and they did not meet Jens at the airport. His flight into San Francisco from Eureka had been delayed by 5 hours due to bad weather. So when he got there, he actually assumed that he had maybe just missed Carol and the girls.
And they already knew about the delay.
Right, exactly. And yeah, that and already, maybe yeah. they went ahead of him.
Yep.
Even though he thought that this was completely out of character for Carol to go against a plan that they had in place, he was still trying to rationalize things. You know, maybe they did catch an earlier flight and they were able to get to Arizona. So he was like, okay, you know, he and his other three children decided they were going to just go to Arizona and check things out.
Okay, I fucking get it, though, because I have to constantly rationalize shit in my head or I, like, my anxiety takes over and it is so bad.
Yeah, you don't want to jump to the worst conclusion. Like, maybe no, it's not that big of a deal.
Every time I jump to the worst, so I have to sit there and be like, okay, this probably happened. This probably happened. This could have happened. It's the only thing that, like, keeps me from going nuts, man.
Of course. When Jens got to Phoenix, he got in the rental car, headed to his sister's place, and realized Carol was not there. The next day, he played a game of golf, then decided that he should maybe call the police. And yes, he became the prime suspect in the case. When he called Cedar Lodge, he was told that the three of them had left. Carol had a credit card on file, and instead of going to the office to check out in person, the room key was left in the room, and all the luggage was gone. So it was assumed she's checking out, she left the key behind. This is not something that isn't typical. Like, people do this all the time.
Yeah, I know. I actually just yelled at Isaac for this recently. I was like, you're supposed to bring it to the front desk.
Yeah, like, I think that you're supposed to, you know, per normal procedures. But a lot of people, like, if you're in a hurry, you got to catch a flight.
It's true.
You don't have time to screw around.
I just get super paranoid that, like, if we don't bring it to the front desk, they're going to charge us for another day or something. You know what I mean? Because it's not, like, right at noon or whatever the hell the time is.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yep, yep. So he contacted the rental car company and learned that the car his wife was using had not been returned. So on Wednesday, February 17th, Jens called the sheriff's department in Mariposa County and reported them missing. A high school student found the plastic insert from Carol's wallet with her driver's license and credit cards on February 19th on the median of an intersection in the city of Modesto, which is a 2-hour drive from Yosemite.
Did you say on the median?
Yeah.
Like, just chilling there?
I don't, you know, I'm not sure if it's, like, sitting on top of or if it was next to and it just says on the median.
Sorry, I was just curious.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a weird thing. My guess is it was next to it. It was winter, so the roads were pretty treacherous, leading people to believe that Carol and the girls had possibly perished in a car accident. Perhaps they had plunged into the river. Once the wallet was found, though, it started to look more like foul play, and the FBI got involved, especially since Silvina was from Argentina. Now they've got a whole other issue on their hands.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The search began, and the park was over 1,100 square miles, and it was located in 3 different counties. Hundreds of officers and agents participated in the search by air, in helicopters and planes, on the ground, by foot and snowshoe, and on water in the lakes and rivers that were surrounding Yosemite. The area was home to the once thriving gold rush, So there were countless abandoned mining caves and tunnels which needed to be searched. Jens had to call Silvina's family in Argentina to tell them their daughter was missing. The victims' families had all come to Modesto, and they were staying at a Holiday Inn. Jens was there with Carol's parents, Francis and Carol Carrington, Silvina's parents, Raquel Peloso, and her husband, Jose, had flown in from Argentina. The Carringtons had posted a $250,000 reward for the safe return of their missing loved ones and another $5,000 reward to anybody who could locate that rental car. During the search, 9 vehicles were found abandoned on various roads around the park, but none of them were the one that Carol had rented.
Okay, but that's concerning.
Yeah, I know. 9 abandoned cars.
That is not normal.
Like, what is going on here? I didn't like it. I'll tell you that.
No. What the hell?
Yeah, that's very bizarre. Carol's husband, Jens, was interviewed for 3 hours, okay? Because it is weird that he, of course, took that flight.
And then went and played golf.
Went to play golf and waited before thinking, hey, something's really wrong here, okay? So at the end of his 3-hour interview, he was asked if they failed to cover anything important. And he said, quote, "You didn't ask me if I did this." He was asked and he said no. He did agree to do a polygraph test, and that was the following day, and he did pass.
Okay, I kind of love that he called him out, though.
Right, like, you didn't ask
like,
me this.
Like, are you gonna do it? Just do it, because we both know.
Let's just get to
that's
it, man.
That's what you're trying to do this whole time.
Yeah. Investigators started back at the Cedar Lodge, which was the last place the ladies had been seen. Even though their luggage had been removed from the hotel room, a few things had been left behind, like a bag with some souvenirs purchased on the trip, an apple, and a bottle of tomato juice in the fridge. So, I mean, probably nothing major there. Maybe the souvenirs, but like the tomato juice and the apple.
Yeah.
I think you can do without that. We leave food behind.
Also, I'm like that person that whenever I leave a hotel room, like, I literally clean everything up and, like, throw everything away so that they don't have to deal with any of it.
Yeah.
So, like, that is immediately weird to me, actually. But also probably not weird to most people.
I don't think a lot of people do that. I think people leave a lot of stuff in the fridge.
No, they probably do.
Yeah. A pink blanket from one of the beds was missing, as well as a pillowcase. And these are items that belong to the hotel.
Oh, so it's one of those pink, like, really soft.
Probably the soft ones.
Yes!
Yeah, the really good ones. Some videos that they had rented from the hotel to watch were there, including the movie Jerry Maguire. The towels in the bathroom were soaking wet, and a soiled sanitary napkin was in the trash can. There were little cuttings from fabric on the hotel carpet that kind of stumped investigators, but this became a major part of the case later.
Okay.
Agent Reinick was going to interview everyone at the Cedar Lodge who may have had contact with the missing women. The first person on the list was the handyman who had changed the locks on room 509 the day Carol had rented the room. Carol had requested separate room keys for her and the girls, and the hotel had to change the locks to comply with this. Investigators learned that the man's brother was a registered sex offender who had victimized the handyman's daughters. He passed a polygraph test and was moved down the list as a suspect. The FBI had narrowed it down to 55 potential predators. And the next person on the list was 38-year-old Billy Joe Strange, a graveyard shift janitor in the Cedar Lodge restaurant.
I'm sorry. He works a graveyard shift?
Yes.
And his name is what?
Billy Joe Strange.
That is amazing! Come on!
Okay, he's not that amazing, but...
Okay, but the name yes. coupled with that...
For sure.
Yeah.
Okay. He did not have any known contact with the women, but he had a record of violence towards women, and he dated another employee whose husband had died under mysterious circumstances.
God damn it.
The man had been stabbed several times in the back with scissors and drowned in the creek, and Whoa. It was ruled a suicide.
Whoa.
Which, you're going to have sorry. To tell me how that's I'm sorry. Possible.
I'm sorry. Wait, wait, wait.
Yeah.
Did you just say stabbed in the back?
Yeah.
With scissors.
With scissors.
So he just, what, reached his arm around, reached his arm around behind him and just...
Essentially. Stabbed just stabbed him, himself and then dropped into the creek. Yeah.
Wow.
Because that makes a lot of sense. That's really that solid police work there.
Something else right yeah. there.
It's a real head scratcher, I'll tell you.
I mean, wow.
I don't know how we landed on suicide, but okay.
Yeah, because, you know, that's a typical way to do it also. Just stab yourself in the back with scissors.
I've never heard of that like, before, what the fuck? But okay. Yeah. All right. Billy failed the polygraph test and became so angry during the questioning that he almost attacked the examiner. He was arrested for a parole violation, drinking alcohol, and he had stains that looked like blood that were found during a search in his van. Investigators also had another strong lead to follow. Carol and her husband had an account at Wells Fargo Bank, and several inquiries about the account had been logged in their systems. Someone tried to access Carol's bank account, but the calls were not recorded. The bank paid for calls made to their 800 number to be tracked to the number where the call was placed, but this software had not been activated yet at the time.
Of course.
So... That like
the
meant,
camera's not being turned on.
Yeah.
Yep.
That meant that investigators had to track down the numbers where the calls came from, and it turned out that most of the inquiries were from bank employees. They heard about the case and got curious.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Bro, just because you work there.
Does not mean you're privy to that kind of information. That is I'll tell you what.
Rude as fuck.
Yeah, you know... When I worked at the pharmacy and Prince died, we all were pulled into like a meeting and notified that you better not try to look any information up in the computer because it will be flagged.
I don't even know why that would be something that comes into your mind.
I right agree. Away. Like, that's none of my business.
And I don't. Really care to know either. Like,
mm-mm.
That's your business. Keep it that way.
Absolutely.
Unless it has something to do with a murder investigation, keep it to yourself.
Yeah, like, that's very personal. So, no, I just, it's weird that people would do that, but they did. So, there you go.
The fact that they actually had to tell you is, that's...
Oh, they were real concerned. So...
Yeah, that tells me everything I need to know.
Yep. Other entries were system-generated maintenance, so that makes sense. But two calls appeared to be significant. The first call was placed on February 19th, the day Carol's wallet insert was found in Modesto. The caller was a woman who claimed to be Carol and requested that a duplicate ATM card be sent to her. The employee...
Isn't that sketch?
Yeah, and so the employee that took this call... asked for identifying information that the woman was not able to provide. So, per bank policy, the call was ended. Since the call was ended, the employee did not get the address that the woman wanted the card sent to. So, it was really difficult to figure out.
Yeah.
The second call came in a few days later, on February 22nd, and this was also a woman claiming to be Carol. She provided her social security number and obtained some information, like the balance on the account.
But then they probably asked her what her dog's name was in, like, second grade, and she couldn't fucking remember.
Yes, that's exactly what it was.
I hate those stupid things because I always am like, I know this one. Like, it's about me. I've got this. And then I go to, like, answer the security questions, and it's like, you are incorrect. And I'm like, fucking how?
Yeah. I hate those.
Yep.
Joe Klass, the granddad of Polly Klass, who was kidnapped and murdered at age 12, attended the vigil and said, quote, "This poor family, surrounded by members of other families in a bond of love that exists between those who have had loved ones stolen, a common bond of agony, a common bond of love, in the name of Carol, Julie, and Sylvina, let us dedicate ourselves to a new crusade for peace in the most violent nation on earth. Why is this the country where it's unsafe for a 12-year-old to walk her dog? Why is this the country where it's unsafe for a 15-year-old and a mother and a daughter to visit Yosemite National Park? Don't ever think you're safe until we learn as a nation to solve this problem." Carol's daughter, 13-year-old Gina Sund, read a poem in front of roughly 1,000 people. Quote, "Deep in my heart, I know something my mind does not want to learn. I try to stay strong because I know that's what you'd want your baby to be, but mommy, I don't want you to leave me."
Oh my God, don't do this to me.
I know. It's so sad. It's just heartbreaking. The day after the vigil, on March 15th, 1999, a police officer in Modesto came across a guy named Michael Larwick, who was cruising in the same spot where Carol's wallet had been discovered. Police officer Steve Silva was on patrol, and he noticed Michael began to follow him, and it was obviously suspicious, but he couldn't do anything about it right away. He had to wait for, like, an actual reason to pull him over, and then, aha, his tags on his license plate were expired.
Okay, but seriously, when does a cop actually wait for a reason?
They're not all bad. We're not going to jump on that bandwagon. Don't get us in trouble like that. Don't you dare.
I'm not saying they're all bad, but I'm just saying.
We do hear a lot of stories about that, yes.
Many, 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 many of stories.
But luckily this one waited.
They don't wait for a reason, I'm just saying.
Yes. So Officer Silva flashed his lights, but Michael decided he was not going to stop. He was accelerating. A high-speed chase began, and Michael swerved through a residential neighborhood and took a sharp turn. He hit a van, landed at a convenience store, and totaled the car. Once the car stopped, he hopped out and took off
and
running.
And ran.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now, always. Silva chased him, but Michael started firing a gun at him, and Silva was struck with a bullet. Michael was able to get inside of a house, and he barricaded himself inside. The homeowners were away, and police arrived to flush him out.
Okay, at least they were away.
Right.
Thank goodness
for
that.
But could you imagine coming back to something like this?
Yeah, but also I wouldn't want to be sitting at home when something like this went down.
Right, absolutely. There was a standoff for several hours, and the police shot tear gas into the home, and Michael finally walked out on his own. Michael Larwick had a long criminal record that included assault and battery, rape and abduction. His behavior was extremely suspicious, and everyone assumed that he was involved in something bigger. So he became an obvious suspect in the case. Like, why would you just take off like that? You know, Michael Larwick had grown up just miles from where Carol's vehicle had ended up being discovered, and his half-brother was Eugene Dykes, and investigators were already suspicious of him, too. They both took polygraph tests, and Michael's was inconclusive, and Eugene failed. Several witnesses were able to link the brothers to Carol. Witnesses claimed that it was the brothers that had Carol's ID from her wallet, and they were trying to use it for identity theft. These same witnesses said they also had some of the victim's jewelry as well. On March 18th, Carol's rented car had been discovered by a man who was out plinking, which is target shooting with a rifle.
Okay.
So, The car was about 100 feet off State Route 108, a highway north of Yosemite, surrounded by trees, and it had been torched up.
Okay.
Yeah. The man was a local carpenter, Jimmy Powers, and he believed this could be the car that everybody was looking for. So he removed the license plate and took it with him so he could go find a phone.
And, like, I would definitely do that, too, because I would for sure think that, like, in a movie, how you walk away from it for a minute to go call the police, and then you get back and it's gone. I feel like it's gonna leave. I need this as proof.
Yeah, I did see the car.
I swear.
Gas had been poured into the car's interior, and it was set on fire. It burned so hot that it scorched the tree branches that were 25 feet above the car. Tests later determined the heat generated by the fire reached 2,000 degrees. It would have started a forest fire, but everything was covered in ice and snow.
Thank God.
I guess, yeah, at that point, because that's a whole nother problem. The car had been shiny and red, but the paint poured off it like water, and the tires popped and melted. There were two bodies in the trunk, and investigators needed to know where the third victim was. On the ground around the car, there was a shoe, some rope, and Carol's purse that had a bank card, the receipt from dinner at Cedar Lodge, and a camera. The purse was not burned, so the film was developed, and this actually provided time-stamped photos to piece together a timeline. The entire trip had been documented, but the photos ended with the three women in their room at Cedar Lodge. Before the bodies were identified, Carol's husband, Jens, released a statement saying, quote, "The senseless waste of these precious lives is so incomprehensible. I can't even begin to understand why it happened. They were victims of a devious, calculating criminal who most likely is still in the Yosemite area. And so it is with sad irony that not only have we lost what dreams and hopes we had for our teenagers, but we lose the sort of person today's world most desperately needs." The victims in the trunk were identified as Carol and Sylvina, and they had been killed before the car was set on fire because they did not have smoke in their lungs. Carol's stomach had ingredients from the vegetarian burrito that she had for dinner at the lodge, so it was starting to look like the women were attacked at the hotel.
Right, and you said the last picture taken was in their room, right?
Absolutely. Sure was.
Okay.
Which is really chilling, too, when you look through the photos. They were in the book.
Oh, shit, they have them all in there?
Yeah, and so you see how much fun they're having, and they're hiking, and they're smiling.
Oh.
And then they're doing cartwheels in the hotel room. And then it just ends. And it's just really eerie.
Yeah.
Someone reported that a note was found at a restaurant with the words, "Help me," scribbled on it. So investigators started to wonder if that could be Julie. They began knocking on doors in the area to see if she was being held somewhere, but then it all changed when the FBI received a note in the mail that said, quote, "We had fun with this one."
Ew.
Yep.
Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. Oh, God, I'm freaking out. Okay, 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 okay. All right, go ahead.
A map was hand-drawn on the note.
Oh, God, no.
Showing the Vista Point exit to Don Pedro Lake, a reservoir about 50 miles from Yosemite and 30 miles from where the rental car was discovered. There was an X marking the spot where Julie's body could be found. The map was received after the brothers, Michael and Eugene, were locked up. But maybe that meant they had an accomplice. Michael publicly denied any involvement, but his brother confessed to kidnapping and murdering all three women, and he did not mention an accomplice. The FBI brought a cadaver dog to the scene where the map, you know, showed them, and they did find Julie's body.
Oh my God.
Completely hidden under the brush. She was naked, her neck had been slashed, and she had remnants of duct tape around her ankle, indicating that she had been bound. With all three bodies discovered, the FBI circled back to the note that they had received, and it said, "We," which obviously makes it sound like there's more than one person.
Fun with this one.
Yeah. Also, they had crime scenes now that were spread over multiple counties. In mid-June of 1999, the FBI was focusing on a group of suspects that were heavy methamphetamine users. They had conducted more than 10,000 interviews, but they didn't necessarily feel compelled to hurry because they believed that the threat had been contained after they arrested all of the suspects on parole violations or other charges. For nearly 6 months, the Yosemite community had lived in fear, wondering who could be the killer. It was announced that the park was deemed safe again, as all the main players were now in jail.
Oh no. It's something...
It's real bad. Okay.
Is this gonna, like, be like a serial killer or something?
Yep.
Okay.
And this really upsets me because I get that you think you have the person, but you don't know that.
Right. And no, when you were saying, like, that they were like, oh, we kind of don't have to rush on this one because we do think we have the person. Like, I guess maybe when you're doing this all the time, you just get in that mindset. But I could never be in that type of mindset because I would be like, no, I absolutely don't know for sure. And I'm not going to settle until I do.
I think it's healthy to second guess yourself. Am I really doing the right thing here?
Yeah.
Do I really have the right person? Does all the evidence lead to this person, or am I trying to fit the evidence to this person?
Yep.
You know? 26-year-old Joey Armstrong was a strong outdoors woman. She was lively and ambitious, and she had rented a cabin in the park that was isolated. Joey's goal was to teach others, especially children, to love and appreciate nature so that they'd want to protect it. She majored in parks and resource management, and she worked at an Audubon Center on the San Francisco Bay, the Marin Headlands Institute, and at an outdoor education camp for school kids in Sonora before landing her dream job with the nonprofit Yosemite Institute, teaching children about nature and wildlife in the park. She moved into the cabin that is known as the Greenhouse in the Meadow. She and her roommates paid $1 a year to live in the house, which was leased to the Institute by the Park Service. Joey had never spent the night alone in the cabin, but in the second week of July, one of her roommates was going away and Joey's fiance was going to take some kids on a wilderness trek. She made plans to drive down to the Bay Area and stay with a friend in Sausalito. She was going to spend a night alone on July 20th, then she would head on the trip the next day. A local friend invited her to spend the night at her place so that she didn't have to be alone, but she decided not to go. She could spend one night.
I can't. I absolutely, no, I can't. I literally can't.
It's not my thing.
I have to have somebody else, in, at least in the household with me. I cannot.
Yeah.
No.
I agree.
No. No, no, no.
My mind goes to cuckoo crazy.
I would not sleep even a little bit.
Yeah. I'd be pestering the cats all night. Save me.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
The night before she was murdered, she told her father that she felt safe again because the FBI said the killer was behind bars. In her diary, she wrote, quote, "The monsters are gone."
That is fucking sad.
It's so fucked up that this was released to the public and they were wrong. So wrong.
Right.
A day before her murder, Joey emailed her friend saying, quote, "You should come see this place. I wonder if you ever will. I love my garden and living in Yosemite, one of the most beautiful places in the whole wide world." On the morning of Wednesday, July 21st, Joey walked back and forth between her cabin and Toyota truck as she was loading it up and getting ready for her trip to Sausalito. She had no idea that a man was watching her from a little bridge just a short distance away. The front door to the cabin was open, and Joey was listening to music on her stereo. The man approached her. They made small talk, and then he attacked her. When Joey failed to show up to her friend's place in Sausalito, her friend called the police. The U.S. Park Service sent a ranger to the greenhouse to check on her. The cabin door was open, the stereo was on, nobody was home, but her truck was there, packed with all her belongings. By 7:30 a.m., a dozen rangers were searching the area. They found a pair of sunglasses on the porch that looked like they had been stepped on and partially crushed. Around 1:30 p.m., a woman's body was discovered partially submerged in a creek 100 yards from the house. But they didn't know it was Joey because the victim had been decapitated. Yeah, so really brutal.
I didn't see that coming.
It took several hours and a trained dog to locate the head, which had sunk to the bottom of a pool about 40 feet away from the corpse.
Stop!
I know.
Oh, God. Nope. Mm-mm.
Joey was clothed, but her pants were undone and her bra had been pushed up over one breast. The vegetation around the area had been trampled, indicating that there had been a chase. After the discovery, the police refused to believe that there was a link between Joey's murder and Carol, Sylvina, and Julie's murders.
Oh, because they put them away, right?
Exactly. So it's got to be somebody else. The weekend after her murder, an article in the Modesta Bee said, quote, "Freckled, red-haired, and full of energy and enthusiasm, Armstrong loved children, nature, and teaching. Those loves took her to Yosemite, a place known for its peace and beauty. For the past year, she had worked for the Yosemite Institute, a nonprofit group that runs education programs through a partnership with the National Park Service." Mike Lee, the Yosemite Institute's director, said, quote, "Joey was a bright light to all who knew her. We will remember her as so full of laughter and love and as a committed and gifted teacher." On Friday, July 23rd, Agent Reinick learned that there was a surprising twist in the case. Carrie Stainer, the brother of the kidnapped victim, Stephen Stainer, was believed to be a possible witness to Joey Armstrong's murder.
Shut up.
I told you it was coming.
What?
We got there. And by the way, Yosemite and Modesto, these are all areas that we had discussed in the Stephen Stainer case, but I didn't think you'd pick up on those.
That is why it sounded so familiar in the beginning. That is why I made that face. That makes so much sense now.
Yeah.
That's because I was like, why does that sound
It was like a partial light bulb.
But then, but it never fully got there because, like, I was trying to, like, focus it on being one specific situation, but that makes a lot of sense now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I was actually just thinking about that today on my way to work. Cause like when I was it was funny because when I was listening to the podcast, like, and I realized, oh shit, I've already heard this one before, but I actually haven't. Like, oh shit. I just lost my train of thought. Never mind. Out the window. Peace right out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then.
Yeah, I don't know where I was going with it.
You let me know if that train comes back.
Well, you know, it normally does, but it's at a really, really bad time when it does.
That's okay.
Okay.
All right. Carrie was in his 30s, and he appeared to be honest, laid back, and friendly. He was very experienced at fixing things, and he worked at the Cedar Lodge. During a canvass of residents, a neighbor who was a Yosemite firefighter recalled seeing a sport utility vehicle with a distinctive paint job, a baby blue International Scout with white stripes that was parked near Joey's house the night she was killed.
Now that's pretty distinct.
Absolutely. A park ranger also reported giving a ride that same night to a man whose car, also a blue and white Scout, had broken down on the highway between the Foresta turnoff and El Portel. He said he drove the man to Cedar Lodge because he said he lived there. Reinick was told that he needed to make contact with Carrie Stainer, who happened to be at a nudist resort called Laguna de Sol in Sacramento County.
It sounds fancy.
Sure. some deputies from the Mariposa County Sheriff's Department found a vehicle matching that description parked on the side of Highway 140 outside the park. There's a popular skinny dipping spot nearby that the locals refer to as the 25 mile per hour beach because it's located on a sharp curve in the highway that's marked by a 25 mile per hour speed limit sign.
Okay.
So, okay.
Cool.
The deputies and two park rangers found Carrie Stainer sunbathing, nude, and smoking pot.
Nice.
You know, as you do.
That's like...
typical day.
Like, if you're going to be found by the police.
Right.
In some way, that's got to be it.
It has to. That's usually how they find me.
That's freaking beautiful. Oh, my God.
They waited until he headed back to his truck to approach him because they were hoping to get his consent to search the vehicle. Carrie said he was not in Foresta the day before, and he agreed to let them search his vehicle, but he did not allow them to search inside the backpack. They told him that they were just going to get a search warrant for the bag, so he relented and handed it over. Since he acted weird about it, the team decided to wait for that warrant to go through before checking the bag. That night, a park ranger and an FBI agent picked up Carrie for an interrogation that lasted a few hours. He again denied being in Foresta, and he said he had nothing to do with Joey's murder. The investigators had taken photos at the crime scene of the tire tracks that were outside of Joey's cabin, and they compared that over to the tires that were on Carrie's Scout. His tire treads were really unique because he had a different brand and age of tire on each wheel.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it looked similar to the photos of the tracks.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
That's not great for your car.
It's really not a good choice. Just letting you know, like, if you've got that going on and you have the funds to not have that going on. Don't.
Yeah, don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Visitors do get lost in the parks, as you can imagine. So the Park Service employs professional trackers who are experts at following trails. Mark Fincher was not provided any details about the case, and he picked up on two sets of footprints that were coming from Joey's cabin, one slightly in front of the other. The two people walked past Joey's car, then forward to where track tires left by another vehicle could be seen. The pairs of footprints morphed into one single deeper set. Mark Fincher said it looked like someone had come down and swooped Joey up to heaven. Like she just disappeared in these footsteps. Oh. The kidnapper had picked her up, which made his footprints heavier and deeper as he stood and placed her into the car. Carrie's backpack was searched, but they didn't find anything incriminating. They did find a couple things that were interesting. He had a novel called Black Lightning by horror novelist John Saul, which is about a grisly serial killer who cuts women open while they're still alive. Is
who
this
did
one
you say
have?
Is by?
John Saul.
No, that's my favorite fucking author!
Okay. Well, so he had this book, which doesn't mean a lot because you could find that in our bags.
No, I literally have like a crap load of John Saul books up in my room and I actually got his autograph.
Oh.
I sent him a letter once telling him like, I was just like, you're a freaking incredible writer because like, oh my God, I like literally you read one single page of his books and it's
and
like
you're hooked.
You are, like, sucked into a portal, and you are not coming out until you finish that whole damn book.
Sure.
And so, like, I wrote to him, and I was just like, I love, like, your writing. It's just really incredible. And he sent me back a bunch of, like, autographed bookmarks and stuff.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
I like
that.
That
is actually really cool. I'm sorry. I just got, like, really excited because I don't typically hear, and I'm positive it's the same one, yeah, because he does all horror stuff, but. It's just I've never really heard anybody else mention his name before, so it really threw me for a loop.
I mean, so there you go. Like, you would find one of those books in Hannah's bag.
Yeah,
so
you know, you totally would.
That doesn't mean a lot. He had an X-Acto knife, but the knife is so small, it certainly wasn't the weapon used to decapitate Joey.
I've got a knife in my bag also.
Yeah. There was also an opened package of sunflower seeds, so, okay.
Honestly, that I've had too in my bag.
So they looked at this and they're like, okay, that's not enough evidence, so they let Carrie go. He went back to Cedar Lodge, sold some of his possessions to other employees to get money to fix his truck, and then he mentioned that it might be time for him to move. When investigators showed up the next morning to talk to him, he was gone. And he had checked into Laguna de Sal and set up a tent by the resort's man-made lake. He paid for two nights when he checked in on Friday, but he packed up his belongings and was already leaving on Saturday morning. The FBI issued a bolo, be on the lookout, for Carrie Stainer when he cleared out of Cedar Lodge so quickly, because they were like, that could look a little suspicious, let's check on it. The media outlets began broadcasting this information, and a guest at Laguna de Sal recognized him and called in the tip. Agent Reinick was sent to pick up Carrie at the resort, and when he arrived, a guy walked up and said, "The guy you're looking for is in the restaurant, eating breakfast, and wearing clothes."
Okay, good to know.
Okay, and that might sound really silly and vague, but it's a nudist colony.
Right. No, so, I know. Yeah.
I mean,
so it's like the one wearing clothes is going to be the one that's weird.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When the resort discovered that the FBI was looking for Carrie, they blocked off the exit from the resort with some vehicles to make sure he was going to be stuck there.
Okay. That's actually pretty freaking smart on their part.
I like it. I do. Once Agent Reinick's team arrived, they split up and entered the restaurant through two separate doorways. When Carrie saw them, he stood up, put his hands on his head, and he was ready to go. Reinick cuffed him, but let him know he was not being arrested. And he told him, quote, "I don't have a clue why we're here other than to ask if you would be willing to come back to our office and be interviewed." He said if Carrie agreed to go, he would drive him there, then drive him back to Laguna de Sal when they were done. And he also needed to search his truck again. And Carrie gave permission for both requests. Reinick and Carrie were on their way to the station, but their 45-minute drive took about an hour due to all the road construction. So they chatted for a while. Carrie said he loved the outdoors and he had been going to Yosemite all his life and he cherished its beauty and serenity. Reinick told him that he worked cases that mainly involved missing children because he was always looking for ways to help the victims' families. Now, he knew that Carrie's younger brother, Stephen, had been kidnapped. Carrie Stainer was just 11 years old when his 7-year-old brother went missing in 1972. For years, he saw posters plastered all over town with a picture of his brother's face that said, "Have you seen me?" And his picture was also on milk cartons. He didn't know what happened to his little brother for 7 years, but Stephen finally escaped from the pedophile that took him, Kenneth Parnell. In 1980, the family was reunited, and the media was stationed all around the Stainer residence, trying to get as much information as possible.
Not only escaped, but saved Timmy, too.
So, yeah, absolutely. He saved Timmy White. Stephen passed away in 1989 from a motorcycle accident. Reinick asked Carrie if there was anything law enforcement could have done to make things better for his family. Carrie said he felt that the sentence that Ken Parnell received was unjust. His brother was held captive for 7 years.
Yes.
So his kidnapper should have at least received the same sentence, which is exactly what we had said, too.
Yes, 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 yes.
Reinick agreed and said the sentence was unfair. Carrie said that when Stephen came home, he just wasn't the same. He was out of control, acting recklessly, and he believed that recklessness contributed to the car accident that killed him. Carrie said that Stephen's kidnapper had basically destroyed their family 3 times. The unexplained disappearance ripped a giant hole in the family, and they spent 7 years not knowing if he was dead or alive, Once he returned, he was a total stranger to them. And when he died so early, they were catapulted back into that trauma all over again. Reinick said that due to the cases he worked, he had contact with several people that could help Carrie feel better and come to terms with what happened to his brother. He said he had tried counseling, but didn't feel that it helped. When they arrived at the station, Reinick brought Carrie to the interrogation room. Then he went out to find out who was going to do the interview. He was told that they believed he had been a witness to Joey's murder, and now he was running away because he was scared. They needed to find out what he saw that day. Since it was a Saturday, there weren't many people around to conduct the interview, so Reinick said he could talk to him and gather some information until somebody else was available to step in. It's not that he can't conduct the interview. He just wasn't well-versed on this case. He didn't know all the details because he hadn't worked it the entire time. Since they had interrupted Carrie's breakfast that morning, he decided to order a pizza, and Reinick and his partner, Hitman, were going to start the interview. They also called in Harry Sweeney because Carrie agreed to do a polygraph test. While they were gathering some information, Carrie said that his uncle, Jesse/Jerry Stainer, they called him both, had been murdered in 1990, and he had been living with him at the time that he was killed.
What is it with this family and their luck?
A lot's happening here. He said that the case was still unsolved. Jerry had come home for lunch, and a burglar was in his home and killed him with a shotgun. He bled to death near the front door, and then Carrie discovered his body. This took a huge toll on him, and a year later, he tried to end his own life.
Oh my God!
Mm-hmm.
I didn't... I know. How did we end up back in this story?
I told you there's going to be some synchronicities happening here. Michael Marchese was a friend that worked with Carrie, and he said that he found Carrie in the parking lot outside of work, and he was shaking and incoherent. Michael felt that he was in the middle of a complete break with reality, and this all happened after his uncle had been murdered. And so he tried to talk to him, but Carrie wasn't making any sense. According to Michael, quote, Carrie said he felt like he was having a breakdown and said he was all nervous and didn't know why. Carrie said he felt like getting in his truck, driving into the office, and killing everyone in there and torching the place. Michael and his coworkers made sure that Carrie got help, and he was driven directly to the local hospital to be evaluated. His condition stabilized, but he did decide to leave his job. When he picked up his final check, he told everyone he was heading to Santa Cruz and he was going to go to school to become a cartoonist. Reinick said he actually worked cold cases too, so he could call Merced County, where his uncle's murder occurred, to see what he could do. The pizza and the polygrapher arrived at the same time. They asked Carrie, which one do you want to do first? And he said they could skip the polygraph. He wanted to talk to Reinick alone.
Oh, okay.
Carrie was slumped over with his head down and he was crying when Jeff Reinick entered the room. He said, quote, Jeff, I'm a bad person and I've done really bad things. He said that he struggled with terrible and obsessive thoughts about molesting and killing prepubescent girls. Reinick told him that doing bad things doesn't necessarily mean you're a bad person, nor does having bad thoughts. He said they could talk things through and figure it out together. Carrie said that he had been molested by one of his uncles when he was 11 years old, which was the year his brother Stephen had been kidnapped. He said he was never able to achieve an erection to have a normal sexual relationship with a woman. He talked about being in a constant state of anxiety and engaging in compulsive behaviors to relieve that anxiety. He would pull his hair out, leaving bald patches on his scalp, and he usually wore a baseball hat to hide this. Carrie said, quote, I can give you closure. Reinick asked, on what? And Carrie said, quote, this and more. This didn't make a lot of sense, but Reinick thought about that long conversation they had in the car on the way to the station. He had told Carrie that he struggled with the concept of closure from his experiences in working murder cases, and he said that it affected him and his family. Could that be what Carrie was referring to? Reinick asked what he meant by more, and Carrie said, quote, "You know what I mean." Reinick said, "One more?" He thought that he might be referring to his uncle's unsolved murder case. And Carrie said, "More." Reinick asked him if he was talking about the three tourists, and Carrie slowly nodded. Did this make sense? Reinick was told that they had already put away a group of people that were involved in the Sund Pelosa murders. Carrie was supposed to be a witness to Joey's murder. Now he's confessing to all four murders. Carrie said, quote, "You work all kinds of cases. I'd like to see pictures of little girls." Reinick was stunned. He was like, child pornography? Carrie would not say it in those words, but he said, quote, "You know, pictures and videos of little girls." He said that he assumed they might have evidence like that stored in the building. Reinick excused himself to go talk to his partner, Hitman.
This feels so weird.
I've never seen you so quiet.
I'm so freaking confused. This just all feels very, very weird.
So he goes out to talk to his partner, and he says, you know, "I can pass the request up the chain of command," but neither of them could imagine a scenario where they would be allowed to hand him child pornography. They weren't sure how to proceed with the interview, so they ate the pizza they ordered, and Carrie said, quote, "This is gonna be my last pizza. Never got to see Star Wars."
What the shit?
Reinick told him he would be giving a gift by telling the truth, and he would get some relief out of this. He said, quote, "You're going to feel good. Not good, but you're going to feel peaceful. Probably a feeling you haven't had in a long time." Carrie said, quote, "It means I can die with a clear conscience now. Whenever that day comes, I know they're going to give me the death penalty. Even if I confess, they are going to give me death." He continued, "It's weird because I love life so much." He explained that one minute he'd be enjoying time with friends, marveling at nature and thinking high-minded thoughts, quote, "and the next minute it's like I could kill every person on the face of the earth. It just mentally tortures you, constantly back and forth like a tennis match." Reinick asked if his family knew about the things that he struggled with over the years, and he said he never told anyone, not even his closest friends. Carrie said he had first started imagining scenarios of harming women and girls when he was 6 or 7. He imagined having a neighbor girl trapped in an underground bunker. The thoughts and fantasies started before his brother's kidnapping, and then he was molested by his uncle. According to a psychiatrist who later evaluated Carrie Stainer for his defense team, the Stainer family tree was riddled with mental illness and sexual abuse that went back 5 generations.
Holy crap.
According to the psychiatrist's report, Carrie's father, Delbert Stainer, was ordered into therapy for molesting his own daughters. Then, one of his sisters said that Carrie started peeping on her inappropriately, touching her when she was 10. A cousin said that Carrie spied on her and his sisters and a neighbor girl while hiding under their beds and secretly videotaping them in the bathroom and bedroom.
What the fuck?
One relative described the sexual abuse as, quote, "like a family sickness," because it had gone on for so many generations. So,
I don't even have words for that. Holy this is a shit.
Very, very, very different side to the family than what we had previously right. discussed and seen.
This is like
all the monsters are coming out. Yeah.
Wow. It's just, and it's really especially mind blowing me because of his brother being in that situation.
Right.
And then him actually fantasizing about it.
Yeah, before his brother was even kidnapped.
Oh, God.
It's just crazy.
Oh.
And the thing is, so Stephen, when he was kidnapped, was being sexually assaulted.
Right. My brain went there, too.
And then at the same time, Carrie's being sexually assaulted
right.
by an uncle. And then their father is going after the girls. So all of the children were assaulted.
Oh, my God.
In this family.
Which is even crazier because in that story, like, there were other kids brought in temporarily
uh-huh.
to Steven's situation where he was being held.
Right.
And they also had, like, situations happening. And it's just like, oh, my, this is disgusting.
It really is. Like, such a tangled web happening here.
Oh.
So.
I might need Disney after this one just because, holy shit.
I truly have never seen you so quiet.
I didn't. I really was trying to take that in.
Yeah.
But it was also, like, confusing and so much was happening. And
what?
Right. Okay. Yeah. I think I might need to watch Disney after this.
Yeah. So we've got one more part. And in the next one, we're going to break it down further of what actually happened during these murders. And we're going to get the full confession out of Carrie.
Okay.
So.
The full confession.
Yeah.
Why'd you say it like that?
Well, I just find it so crazy.
Like, as in, like, are you saying that, like, he's, like, definitely the one that did it?
Oh, he did it.
Oh, my God.
I'm not even going to beat around the bush on that one. He did it.
This is fucking nuts.
Yeah. So we went from a child being kidnapped to his brother
being
is a serial killer.
Murderer.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a lot for a family to take.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just going to have to end it because all I got right now is wow.
And, you know, when I watched the show on it, Steven's wife, she had discussed how their children never knew Steven's parents. Like, Kay and Del were never around his kids. And I thought that was really odd until I read this book. And I thought, well, if he's in trouble for molesting his children,
right.
why on earth would they put their kids in harm's way?
Correct.
That doesn't make any sense. So maybe it was a form of protection.
Wow.
I don't know.
That's all I've got still is wow.
Either way, like, this book is really, really good. So if anyone's looking, and it has, like, several stories that this specific agent was involved in. So, okay. All right. So make sure to follow us on any of your podcast apps. Tell us the stories you want to hear. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Leave us a 5-star review if you love us. Tell your friends. Tell your cats. Bye. Bye.